talking now. Now! It is the last chance, and you may turn to the light and be as you were. I pray you, my son.
No!
My son.
No. You risked my life for the book! You made me carry the sign! You never let me die! Now it is your turn!
Stop! In the name of the Circle of Signs, I command you to leave this house!
Masters of the Dark, I bring you in!
I found better masters than you.
Masters of the Dark! I bring you in!
And the nine flames moved in closer from the walls to the center of the room, approaching Will and the outward-facing Old Ones, chilling them to their hearts.
Your circle is not complete, man. And has not that force. And your liegeman has called us into this house as he did before and can again. Our liegeman, my lord. The hawk is in the dark.
I am here.
Merriman, oh, I'm so cold. These fires, these candles.
So.
That is what is bringing in the deep cold.
Even as he thought this, his own century began to fade back in around them. Friends, family, villagers, all reappearing.
It is the cold of the dark.
Hawken has let them in, as he did in his first betrayal, and we cannot prevent that. Our only hope is what it was at the beginning. You see, he is mortal. Hawken is no more than a man, and so he is vulnerable. But when the spells of deep cold are made, Will, there is little that can be done against them.
And they were back once more in the hall of Miss Greythorn's manor.
Really uplifting.
But the cold was there too.
Miss Greythorn, there's not much we can do to warm things up. All the electric power lines and the telephone are dead. But I have had all the house blankets and the quilts brought out.
Oh, good.
The fire runs short of wood, but at least it still burns.
Hmm. Electricity, hmm? Bah! I always knew the old house didn't approve. Good thing we kept the old gas stoves, eh, Lion?
Oh, indeed, madam. I'm having more wood brought out now.
Oh,
oh, oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh no! Oh.
Stand back.
No! Oh. Fire's gone out!
No, down the chimney!
Is that the fire almost to death?
Right, we need buckets and shovels. Quickly!
Quick!
Oh, no!
Will rushed out of the door at the far end of the hall, but as he passed the opening, a ragged figure leapt at him and seized his ankle.
No. Slow down, old one. Last of the old ones. You know what's going up to you? The cold's coming in and the dark will freeze you cold and stiff.
Let's go!
And you know we'll take the little signs, old one. I shall. The poor walker. I'll wear them. They're promised to me by the dark as reward for my services. I shall be the sign seeker. I shall!
It's all right, Will. We
can't.
You're not going anywhere, old
man.
Get off
me. Get off me.
Of all the times to run berserk, this chap is a danger to himself and the community.
You're on, you.
If only you knew what sort of danger he is.
He must be the only war object in the country. I'm going to put him to sleep for a while. It will ease his suffering and ours. So keep him there, John, while I go and get my
bag. Come here, you. Easy now.
Nine great ice candles. They're growing clearer.
Yes. And now Dr. Armstrong was coming back towards the sick room with the black bag. And Will realized
there is a way, perhaps, of stopping the dark before the cold kills us all.
Yes, Will. One person, unwitting, giving help to another.
But hold him still, John. You too, Will. This is for his own good.
The doctor slipped a needle deftly in and out of the walker's arm before the old man knew what she was doing.
Right there, there. That'll help you. You have a deep sleep.
Freeze, you freeze, and the signs will be mine, whatever you try.
And as the mind of the walker closed, the dark's way into the house was closed too.
All right, everyone, you can relax. Everything's under control. Oof.
Well done, Doctor.
Will's head whirled. Miss Greythorne's manor with its throng of familiar faces faded once more, and he was back in time once again in that great hall of the earlier age with the other old ones, and beside the hearth, there was the lady.
Oh, lady, madam, we have returned. Yes, Will, and you have done so very well. Now it is clear what is to be done.
The nine great ice candles of the dark, the candles of winter. Take them before they fade.
And the old ones scattered hastily into the hall, where the strange blue-white cylinders still burned ghostly with their dead cold flames. Will leapt hastily onto a chair to seize the last. It was cold and smooth and heavy to his touch.
Like ice that does not melt.
Bearing the winter candles of the dark, the old ones advanced towards the great quartered iron circle of holders on the massive wooden table, and one by one they placed the candles into eight of the nine sockets.
Now, Will Stanton, our candles are in place.
You must complete the sign of fire.
Will reached through to fit his candle into the last holder in the very center of the pattern.
Seized from the dark, Will Stanton. By cold magic, they called up the candles of winter for destruction. But now that we have seized them for the light, the candles become stronger and able to bring you the sign of fire. See?
The flame of the candle that Will had placed began to grow. Its flame stood high above the rest. It became yellow, orange, red. It grew into a curved, strange flower of flame. And then each petal opened and melted away into the air, leaving only a glowing, round seed pod, which broke open silently to reveal a golden red circle of a shape they all knew.
Take it, Will.
I'm ready.
But he was not, for as he put out his hand, the great slender flower stalk bent over towards him, and the golden circle fell into it, and he staggered at the surge of invisible power that struck him.
This is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Like fire made metal. And there are words on it. No, in it. Light, neck, hurt.
The light ordered that I should be made.
Let the sign bring light.
The sound of the dark's thwarted fury beat in his ears, and suddenly time moved forward. And Will was back again in Miss Greythorne's hall, and all around him were friends and family and villagers, their faces now turned wonderingly to the roof and the rumbling roar beyond.
What is that? Thunder? Rain! It's rain!
Excellent! Excellent! The thaw's here at long last.
Will, am I going loopy, or does this perishing room suddenly feel warmer?
No. Yes, it's warmer. It's warmer!
Funny. It was so hideously cold for a while. I suppose they've got the central heating going again.
No. They haven't given up. Of course the dark has not given up.
Will, Paul, come quickly. It's your brother James.
Get Dad now. And the doctor. Mum's had an accident. She fell down the stairs. She's still unconscious. And we think she's got a broken leg.
No!
Okay, wait there, Will. Dad?
Did they do that? Did they? The lady said...
It's possible. They cannot harm you, true, and they cannot destroy mortals. But they can encourage men's own instincts to do them harm. Or bring an unexpected clap of thunder when someone is standing at the top of a flight of stairs.
I'm sorry, Dad, I didn't know what else to do.
Will, come with me, Paul and James. Home as fast as we can. Run! Now!
Wei Guo's autobiography. I'm Wei Guo, 24 years old. I've not kept a diary for a long time, but today, this diary has to be written down as a historical record. Today, I made a great stride towards my life goal because today, I became an official member of the SS Study Group. I feel so proud because I am its youngest member. The SS Study Group brings together political and business circles. Its formal members include government officials of vice ministerial rank, army officers of major general rank, directors of major state-owned enterprises, chairmen of sovereign funds, and leaders of China's top 100 private businesses, as well as a few professors and institutional heads from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences and key universities. In fact, our network of connections extends all the way up to the heavenly court. We're not ivory tower bookworms. We study political and legal thought and scholarship concerning statecraft and how to assist the state in governing the nation. Our motto is perfect wisdom and courage. We promote a martial spirit, heroism, and the robust qualities of manliness. We constitute a new generation of superior men with a sense of mission. In this age of mediocrity without any sense of honor, we courageously affirm that we are the genuine spiritual aristocracy of China's golden age of ascendancy. Of course, not all our members come from revolutionary families. Some of our academic members are from commoner or intellectual families, but most do. My grandfather, on my mother's side, was a judge of the Republic, and I grew up in a big courtyard full of people from political and legal circles. Still, I could be regarded as the one with the least illustrious background in the group. Perhaps I should be thankful to Professors X, Y, and Z, especially to Professor X, because they're the ones who nominated me to be a member in waiting a year or so ago. Thus, I was finally able to become an official member today. Professor X brags that he's the one who spotted me first. I let him think so, but in actual fact, when I was studying first-year law, I investigated all of my professors to see which one had the best future prospects and which one would go the furthest in the shortest period of time. And I chose Professor X. I made the right choice, too. Professors X, Y, and Z are the founders of the SS Study Group. Their position is that ideas and power should be united in order to make China stronger. Because they'd already mastered the Western and Chinese classics, they were able to attract to the group those government officials, army officers, and business executives interested in political thinking. X, Y, and Z want to become state tutors, and they believe that within 10 years their ideas will control the fate of the nation. All of this is in perfect accord with my own 10-year plan. Of the three, X controls an important scholarly journal, has the widest circle of connections, and is the most popular with the media. He has the biggest mouth, too, and is rumoured in the academic world to have a national security background. Y has the highest academic standing, is the leader in his field, serves as dean of a newly established faculty in a key university in the South, and is quite well known in overseas academic circles. Z lectures to a research class on national security strategy at the People's Liberation Army's National Defense University in Beijing. This research class is made up of civil and military leaders and includes provincial officials as well as high-ranking officers. Z is the more profound individual, far-sighted in his views, and he is the one who understands me best. There are two particular initiatives of mine that I reported only to him. and when he didn't respond at first, I was afraid that I'd been mistaken about him and regretted being too impetuous. It was Zed, however, who argued in the selection committee that they should ignore their rules and allow me to become an official member of the group even though I hadn't finished my studies. X also claimed credit for this, telling me that he and Zed argued together on my behalf. Otherwise, I would have had to remain a member in waiting for another 3 to 5 years. Youth is too valuable a commodity, so how could I allow myself to be so easily held back by them? I intend to actively accelerate the achievement of my goals. I discovered that Zed was the key to my success because he has a secret relationship with the one person that every member of the group calls Big Brother, Ban Kun Tao. Ban Kun Tao is a genuine red aristocrat. On the surface, he's supposed to be an investor in overseas projects. But in point of fact, he is intimately connected with all of the legitimate and illegitimate activities of the party, the government and the military establishment. He is, as we say, able to communicate with heaven itself. And I believe that he will eventually become one of our nation's heads of state. Everyone in the group is well connected, but they all exhibit reverence and fear when talking to Big Brother Ban Kun Tao. Big Brother Ban Kun Tao and Zed are the real souls of the group, although I don't believe in the soul. Unfortunately, it's not easy to get close to Ban Kun Tao. So far, I've not figured out any way to attract his attention. So I'll just keep working on Zed for the time being. When I was an undergraduate, I already did a lot of running around for X, Y, and Z. They all have different organizations and they control a great many resources. For example, they can allocate funds for research projects to scholars who are willing to be allied with them. They can obtain the support of wealthy foundations to fund high-level academic conferences, support like-minded people, and set up united fronts. They can organize twice-yearly conferences for outstanding graduate students in the humanities to train the next generation of the academic elite, all expenses paid. The food and entertainment are superb, but the mentally intensive brainwashing is also terrific. That's why the conferences have been dubbed the Devil's Training Camp or the New Wanpo Academy. With so many activities, X, Y, and Z naturally have to divide up the work. For example, only Y and Z lecture at the Devil's Training Camp while leaving the organizational work to X. X does not appear up front as the organizer. The nominal organizer is Q, because Q is best at shaking things up and at influencing young people, especially passionately enthusiastic new MA students. Q has a very high opinion of himself and he also aspires to becoming a state tutor, but X, Y and Z look down on him. They say his academic qualifications are insufficient. He's had no scholarly publications and his position keeps changing. In private, they call Q the Pied Piper. Like the Pied Piper of Hamelin in the German fairy tale who played the flute so bewitchingly that he enticed all of the children away from home. X, Y, and Z are clearly aware that in an intellectual revolution, and what the SS study group is promoting is nothing less than an intellectual revolution in which the contemporary Chinese worldview will triumph, there are many roles to be played, and a Pied Piper to lead away the children is indispensable. The first time I confided in Zed about my activities was about the first time I implemented the group's concept that politics is the art of distinguishing between the enemy and ourselves. I told him that from my sophomore year on, I'd organize my classmates to systematically refute reactionary discourse on the internet and to denounce reactionary websites to the authorities. After that, we moved on to simultaneously observing the virtual world and the real world. We would report to the university president and the Communist Party secretary any professor in our university who was promoting the Western system of values or liberalism in class. Our working model spread like a virus and was soon being copied in many other colleges and universities. This clearly made known my operational abilities and demonstrated that many university students listened to me and even worshipped me. I am the charismatic leader of today's youth generation. After Zed listened to all of this, he didn't say much, but I knew that he'd taken it all in. That's because not long after that meeting, he nonchalantly asked, "Have you attended any of Professor Gong's lectures at your faculty?" I immediately understood what he wanted, and after making some inquiries, I learned that Gong had openly criticized the politics of the ancient Confucian Gongyang school in his class. I brought together all the students who'd taken Gong's classes and incited them to denounce him to the university president for slandering traditional Chinese culture. They also launched an online petition demanding that a thorough investigation be carried out and that Gong be fired. This process is not yet complete. But we've given Gong so much trouble, he can hardly take it anymore. I'm quite certain that Zed is very satisfied with my performance. What I didn't tell Zed was that my year-long denunciation activities had finally been appreciated by the government. First, the Internet Monitoring Department of the State Council Information Office, and then the Ministry of State Security formally contacted me. This amounts to saying that I am now an official informer for both public and state security units. I didn't tell Zed or the other members of the group about this either, so that they would not be on their guard with me. When I report to the authorities that I am now an official insider in the SS study group, they will certainly have an even higher regard for me. My second initiative makes an interesting story. 6 months ago, some time after I'd become a group member in waiting, I went to listen to Zed give a public lecture. The topic was the role of love in China's present age of prosperity. In it, he said, "Today, our society is suffused with love, and the media are repeatedly promoting great love, universal love, and love of all mankind. For a while, everybody feels good, their hearts are full of love, they experience a feeling of satisfaction and happiness. The entire nation is harmonious. Crimes of violence decrease, even domestic violence decreases. Thus, we can see the power of love." Every time he used the word love, Zed made hand gestures indicating quotation marks around it. When I was just about bored to death and thinking that Zed didn't have anything new to say, near the end of his lecture, he softly came out with the following sentence. "Everybody is busy loving, so the martial spirit is not on display. There are no enemies, and hatred cannot emerge." His words hit me like a bolt of lightning. Zed is so profound, and he's pondered this topic very deeply, I thought. I remembered that Y once had said, "The vast majority of the people in the world have not received any rigorous philosophical training, and they do not possess the intelligence to understand things clearly. We philosophers cannot tell them the truth, otherwise they would attack us just like they executed Socrates. In a public forum, a philosopher can only say what the masses love to hear and cater to them. Nevertheless, a philosopher may utter a few code words, heeding the difference between insiders and outsiders, and permitting the insiders, members of his own party, to grasp his true meaning, as in the traditional phrase, subtle words carry profound meanings." Zed and Y are kindred spirits, and so Zed was also employing subtle words to carry his profound meanings. He talked about love for the sake of the masses, and they thought he was promoting love, or that he believed China's present golden age of ascendancy needed such love. But in his entire lecture, Zed only described love. He didn't advocate love. He only discussed how love was influencing the Chinese people during this age of prosperity, but he never said that the Chinese people should love more. That one phrase, "the martial spirit is not on display," was the key. It was a repudiation of all the so-called love that came before it. This phrase was the code meant for people like me to hear, because I know from the SS study group that the martial spirit is the virtue that we admire and advocate above all. Zed promotes the martial spirit, and if this martial spirit is positive, then anything that prevents the martial spirit from being displayed cannot be positive. And just what, according to Zed's lecture, prevented the martial spirit from being displayed? It was love. Someone like me, who has received philosophical training and knows how to read between the lines to find the profound meaning, understood that Zed's love, in quotation marks, referred to the previously mentioned great love, universal love, and love for all mankind. In theory, the martial spirit does not necessarily require hatred or enemies, but enemies and hatred can strengthen people's martial spirit. Enemies and hatred are an aphrodisiac for the martial spirit. The real goal of Zed's lecture, his subtle words carrying profound meanings, was to negate the idea that people should love even their enemies, to refute the kind of so-called universal values of great love and love for all mankind that fail to distinguish between the enemy and ourselves. His lecture even implied that we must identify our enemies and let our hatred rise against them so that our martial spirit can be fully displayed. This I understood. I knew this was also the ingenious method I could use later to earn Zed's trust. With his strong idea of the difference between inside and outside forces, he'd surely make me a close member of his inner circle. I immediately organized 6 Peking and Tsinghua University students who already worshipped me into a group of iron-willed, loyal braves and began to practice martial arts with them. I feel that university students today are all lacking in courage and the killing spirit. They've all been over-influenced by society's general mood of love. They've all been feminized and sissified and have lost the lofty male spirit of machismo. Sometimes I'm afraid that even I am too loving, too indecisive, and won't be able to accomplish anything great. I tried my best to stimulate their killing spirit and told them that they must never forget how to hate, must never forget the distinction between the enemy and ourselves. We watched documentary films on the Nanjing massacre and the Nazi extermination of the Jews, and I encouraged them to imagine how they would systematically massacre the little Japanese devils. Then on one occasion, when we were camped out on maneuvers, I wanted them to kill a couple of stray dogs in order to build up their courage, but they let the bastards get away. I think university students are all good-for-nothing losers. Finally, one night, I had the chance to put them through their rite of passage. Every night in my grandmother's crummy little Wu Dao Gou restaurant, 5 flavours, there is a folk music performance. It's a good place for me to keep watch on our young people's attitudes and thinking. That night, all of the iron-willed loyal braves were there, but their morale was pretty low and they were frowning into their drinks. Maybe he'd had too much to drink, but one of them, from Tsinghua University, suddenly pointed at a tall young man on stage playing the guitar and said, "Look at that big shit playing the guitar. One look and you know he comes from the countryside." That Tsinghua iron-blooded loyal brave also comes from a peasant family, but he hates peasants more than anyone else. He was always saying that peasants are a vulgar social class, lower than anybody, and nobody should sympathise with them. I have always known that poor people hate other poor people. Peasants despise other peasants, and children love to bully other children. "Look at him and his dark skin. He's disgusting, isn't he?" said the Tsinghua student. "The tall guy plays pretty well, though," said another brave. But another one disagreed with him. "His body language is so crude and his fingers are as thick as rolling pins and he still wants to play Spanish guitar. Fuck!" "It's just a fucking peasant," the Tsinghua guy, with anger rising in his voice. All the iron-blooded loyal braves stared at that tall peasant guitar player in utter disgust. "Maybe tonight we should," I suddenly thought out loud. They all understood immediately, and one of them said, "Let's go pick up our weapons." We waited outside the restaurant, growing angrier by the minute while that big jerk was still in there drinking and laughing. When he finally came out, we followed him, not knowing exactly how to have a go at him. After a while, we came to a bus stop, and that dumb prick actually sat down against a wall in a narrow street across from the bus stop and went to sleep. All my crew went after him at once, beating the crap out of him with their clubs until the big bum couldn't move even a muscle. I was standing across the street thinking to myself, "This is the real thing. Tonight we're going to beat that fucker to death." But just then, a Jeep Cherokee drove up and everybody scattered. I hesitated for a long time trying to decide whether or not to tell Zed about this action, because the result could have been either extremely good or extremely bad. If X knew about it, he might get scared, and Y might even reprimand me. But Zed probably would think more highly of me if he knew. I decided to take a gamble and tell Zed. I told him that I'd been inspired by his love lecture. I had understood the true meaning of his subtle words and put them into practice. Hate is absolutely indispensable if we want to accomplish great things. What I made clear, but didn't actually say, was that I could carry out important missions for him. Zed listened in his usual way without any obvious reaction and then just walked away. I didn't hear anything from him for quite a few days, but fortunately, events proved that I had understood Zed correctly. Today, I was made an official member of the SS study group. I had bet on the right horse. Now I'm 24. When I was 22, I formulated my 10-year plan and have been fulfilling it step by step. But I must not get too self-satisfied. What was Chairman Mao doing when he was 30 years old? He was one of the 5 members of the Standing Committee of the Chinese Communist Party Politburo. With this in mind, I know that I have to work much harder. P.S. The SS and the SS study group refers to 2 Germans, even though one of them was Jew, whose last names begin with S. The group started up by studying their ideas on politics, theology and philosophy, but later on it was no longer of any importance who they were. P.P.S. I suffer from one minor annoyance. Unfortunately, little she is my mother. She's the one uncertain element in the progress of my project. I have to eliminate this uncertainty. If we're still living under Chairman Mao, she would certainly long since have been condemned as a counter-revolutionary element. But our government has grown much too lenient. I asked my superior in the Ministry of State Security to lock her up in a mental hospital for a long time, but he told me not to worry about her. He said everything was under control, and they wanted to let her move around freely to monitor those she came into contact with. I had no choice. Searching for a lost month. I'm Feng Chaodi, and I'm making this recording. I finally found a true brother. His name is Zhang Du. He is 22 years old from Henan province, and he lives in the village of Hairo outside Beijing. I'm 65 years old, so I have the right to call him younger brother and to occupy the rank of elder brother. Just like me, he remembers everything about that lost month, those 28 days between the time when the world economy went into crisis and China's golden age of ascendancy officially began. 2 years of searching has told me that this is very rare and extremely important. He also has asthma, just like me, and has been taking corticosteroids for many years. This has led me to the bold hypothesis that our not suffering from memory loss has something to do with our asthma. This is wonderful news. It proves that within the boundaries of our nation, there are as many people who still remember what happened that year as there are sufferers from chronic asthma. It's just that they don't know of each other's existence. If I can bring together 100 or 1,000 of these asthmatics, then I can prove to all of our nation's people that that month did in fact exist. Last Friday evening, I went to Wudaogou to see a friend, and the outdoor equipment store on the ground floor of his apartment building was being cleared out and cleaned. I went in to look around, and under a pile of junk, I noticed an old copy of the popular liberal paper Southern Weekly from that lost month. It must have been the last issue they came out with before being forced to stop publishing. I felt like I'd stumbled upon a great treasure, so I just bought a few things and then took the paper along with them. When I compared the printed version of the Southern Weekly with the online version, as I expected, there were many discrepancies. For example, the printed version carried an article critical of that year's a crackdown, but in the online version it had been deleted and replaced by an article explaining why Western universal values are inappropriate for China. I don't know why, but when I saw how the Southern Weekly had been defiled and distorted so that it was now opposed to universal values, I burst out laughing. I forgot that the coffee shop was full of other customers. That lone issue of the Southern Weekly was my document number 71. Evidence for the true historical existence of that missing month. Even more fortunately, in the small hours after I'd left my friend's place and hadn't driven very far, I spotted 5 or 6 young men beating up another man who was lying on the ground. When they saw my car, they all took off running. When I stopped the car, experience told me not to get involved. But while I was hesitating, I realized that the young man was gasping for breath, and that was something I am very familiar with. I got out of the car and walked up to him. I saw his arm shaking, and then I understood. I reached into his trouser pocket and found, as expected, his asthma inhaler. I shoved it into his mouth, sprayed like crazy a couple of times, and he revived. Should I continue to help him, I wondered. Suddenly, I became extremely curious. What was he like, this kid who took the same medication I did? I've had many bouts of this sort of curiosity in my life. You could say that I've travelled my whole life's road on the basis of this sort of curiosity. So I decided to take care of the kid. He was so big and heavy. I had a hell of a time dragging and lifting him into my car. Finally, I got him in and took him to Peking University Third Hospital. I was afraid he would check out and leave the hospital, so I went to see him the next morning. He was still sound asleep. When he woke up in the afternoon, he asked me in a wheezy voice to buy some groceries and take them to his family in Huarou. He wasn't even afraid that I'd disappear with his money. I decided to do what he asked. I'd wait to see the next card, just like in a poker game. By the third day, I knew I'd been right. He remembers that month. We are the same. And I finally proved that I'm not alone. He is Zhang Du, and I made him my brother closer than the flesh and blood brother. In 2 years, he's the only person I've found who's like me. Everybody else is different. At first, I thought all those other people just didn't want to talk about the events of that month. Then later I realized that they recalled things wrongly, completely differently from the way I remembered them. Finally, I came to the conclusion that in all of their memories, there were 28 days missing. In order to verify this memory loss, I went to the library to look up the daily and weekly newspapers from that year. But the library only had online versions, and it was no longer possible to read the printed versions. The online reports of those 28 days were completely different from my memory of them. They held that the world economy had gone into crisis at the same time as the official start of China's golden age of ascendancy. The horrifying month that came between these two historical events had completely disappeared. For a while, I thought that even though the government had distorted the truth, at least the common people would remember what had happened. But later on, I had to admit that it was a case of total collective amnesia. Complete collective amnesia. I suspected that this amnesia was related to the nationwide bird flu inoculation that spring, but I couldn't confirm my suspicion. I started to frequent Beijing's second-hand bookstores, looking for related reports, but all I could find were official government newspapers and mindless entertainment magazines. There were no publications that carried the truth. I bought a Jeep Cherokee in Beijing and took off south on the G4 Beijing-Hong Kong-Macau highway to collect more evidence of that month. It was only in rather strange places, though, that I found a few snippets of corroborating evidence. For example, in a guest house at the foothills of Mount Huang, I found a complete issue of the financial magazine Sai Ching that reported on how the new round of great economic decline in early February of that year was impacting on China. At Hengdian World Film Studios in Zhejiang, I saw part of an Asia Weekly magazine from Hong Kong that reported on how the people were hoarding food that year. In a squalid urban village near Wuhan University in Hubei, I picked up half of an old China Youth Daily published by the Communist Youth League, in which the main article, "The Leviathan Has Arrived," introduced the 17th century Western political philosopher Thomas Hobbes. The general theme of the article was that, given a choice between anarchy and dictatorship, people would always choose the latter. Another article was a retrospective report describing how the government had failed miserably during the 2008 riot of over 10,000 people in Wan'an in Guizhou province, when the police were accused of covering up the death of a young girl. In the Tujia ethnic region of Xiangxi in Hunan, I found an incomplete clipping from the Southern Weekly. It was an advertisement on how to use a made-in-China radio, because at that time, many people were afraid that the power supply would fail and they would not be able to watch TV or surf the net, so they bought radios. On the reverse side of that advertisement was an article discussing the 1983 crackdown on criminality. As time went by, media evidence was harder and harder to come by. That's why I was so ecstatic when I found that late February Southern Weekly with its clear evidence of that missing month. I became much more anxious to find people like myself. I made a list of all the people I knew, the ones I believed, always to have a clear understanding of things I called clear-headed people. I went to talk to these clear-headed people one by one, but came back disappointed every time. Am I like the lone survivor on Earth that we see in these apocalypse movies? But the heroes in those films are always destined to find other survivors later on. I relied on that idea to persist resolutely in my search. Finally, I met Zhang Du. We both believe that this is only a beginning. Out of more than a billion Chinese people, there must be many more like us. I told Zhang Du I'd been going to his home every day to see if Miao Miao and the dogs and cats needed anything. I like his kind and smiling Miao Miao and her pets more and more. Zhang Du said that when he got out of hospital, I could come and live with them. I was quite excited. I need a safe place to store my accumulated evidence. I hope Zhang Du gets out of the hospital soon. A supplementary tape recording. I spent a few days visiting several big hospitals pretending to be sick, but actually taking a look at their asthmatic patients. I tried to raise the issue of the missing month, but I was disappointed because none of them remembered it. I thought everyone taking corticosteroids would be just like Zhang Du and myself. But I was mistaken. I told Zhang Du about my discovery, but I also told him that we must not give up. We absolutely must not forget how lonely we used to be. As long as there might be Chinese people who have not forgotten that month, we definitely have to look for them. To prevent us forgetting, here is another supplementary tape. Last week, on New East Road, I ran into Old Chen, a former journalist for Mingbao and the United Daily. I remembered that he used to be one of my clear-headed people who once helped me out with something important. Is he still a member of the clear-headed group? From the look in his eyes, I think the chances of him still being one of us are not great. But I should not let any opportunity go by. Look him up when you have time, I said to myself. Old Chen's notebook on Fang Chao Di. Little C or Fei Chen Wu Rao, okay, didn't return my email. But Fang Chao Di sent me one asking me to come and see him. I didn't answer him immediately. Recently, all I'd been thinking of was Little C, and I couldn't seem to stop. But what was really weird was that when I thought about Little C, I also started thinking about Fang Chao Di. I kept thinking about that time I saw him jogging near Happiness Village number 2 and all the Mo Lei Tou nonsense he kept spouting. For all the many years I've known him, I noted to myself, he's always called me Old Chen. But this time he actually called me Master Chen. I even started to think that Fang Chaudi's state of mind seemed to be in some inexplicable manner similar to Little C's. The other day, I opened up a box that I'd not opened since moving to Happiness Village No. 2 and took out my notebooks. One of them was entitled Fang Chaudi. I started to read what I'd written. Fang Chaudi, original name Fang Li Jun. Later on, when an artist with the same name suddenly became famous abroad, the Fang Li Jun I knew changed his name to Fang Chaudi. I first came to know Fang Chaudi when I was an editor at Hong Kong's Ming Bao and frequently received letters from an American reader signed Old Fang. Sometimes he corrected facts or evidence given in an article, but more often he'd be offering us a great deal of related material, most of which was too detailed to print. I came to know that Old Fang understood a great many unofficial and secret aspects of contemporary China. Once I put a notice in the reader's section asking him to give his real name and address, and he did. I even wrote back to thank him. He paid particular attention to my articles, and he could even spot the ones I'd written under a nom de plume for the China page of Ming Bao. To use a modern expression, he was my fan. We first met in the summer of 1989 in Hong Kong, when he was on his way back to the mainland. I was surprised that he wanted to enter China at a time when so many others were trying to get out. He asked me if I was familiar with the organization that was rescuing leaders of the Tiananmen democracy movement. I told him there was a Hong Kong alliance in support of democratic movements in China, but at that time, I didn't know there was also a secret organization spiriting people out of China. I realized that his life experiences were quite unusual, so I invited him to meet me again the next day, and then I made these notes. Fang Lijun's, or Fang Chaudi's, ancestors came from Shandong. He was born in what was then known as Beiping in 1947. His father had joined the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in Xinjiang, the restive northwestern province, together with the Xinjiang warlord Sheng Shikai. Later, he went over to the Nationalist Party. In 1949, just before the People's Liberation Army entered Beiping, he boarded a plane to Qingdao and then took a ship to Taiwan, leaving behind his young third wife and his youngest child, Fang Lijun. Sheng Shikai's branch of the Communist Party was a quite different affair from the Communist Party of Zhu De and Mao Zedong. The former had once actually advocated that Xinjiang, with almost half its population being Muslim, become independent from China. Fang Lijun's father not only betrayed the Communist Party, however, he was also closely involved with criminal gangs in the Northwest and was responsible for training people with special skills for them. Fang Lijun was born in an historic old Taoist temple on the east side of Beijing. After liberation, this temple was taken over by the Ministry of National Security. That shows how vigilant the Chinese communists were about Taoist supernatural techniques. After they took power across the entire country, the Chinese communists started a campaign to suppress counter-revolutionaries. From 1950 to 1953, they cracked down severely on clandestine nationalist agents, organized crime and members of religious organizations and secret societies. Anyone possessing Taoist-style special skills was liable to be considered part of a counter-revolutionary secret society. Mao Zedong suggested that one out of every 1,000 Chinese fitted these counter-revolutionary categories, and that the party should first execute half that number. Large numbers of people who'd worked for the nationalist government but then had surrendered, and even people who'd worked underground for the Communist Party in the white areas, were also executed at this time. They included the writer Jing Yong's father, Jia Shuqing, and the essayist Zhu Jiqing's son, Zhu Meixiang. After the campaign to suppress counter-revolutionaries, the criminal gangs and religious secret societies went into hiding and their voices were silenced throughout the land for quite some time. The leaders who'd escaped most promptly went to Taiwan or Hong Kong. Fang Lijun's father was implicated in all forms of counter-revolutionary secret activities, and so he went to Taiwan. Fang Lijun's mother, who was a Taoist secret society big sister, was not so fortunate. She died in a Beijing prison. As for Fang Lijun, the offspring of a counter-revolutionary nationalist spy and criminal gang member father and a religious secret society mother, he grew up in an impenetrable Taoist temple where there were no longer any religious activities. He was raised by an old gatekeeper and later helped the old man with many temple repairs. He finished upper middle school in the process. Fang Lijun was not allowed to go to college due to his shady family background. Because he was a few months too old, he was also not eligible to be sent to the countryside with the three old classes of 1967, 68 and 69. He was even less eligible to become a Red Guard. At the start of the Cultural Revolution then, he'd been assigned to teach in an elementary school in the Mengtougou district of Beijing. But before he could even start, the Cultural Revolution reached a more intense level and he was sent off to work as a coal miner in the Muchenjiang mine, and there he stayed for several years. According to his account, one day in September 1971, he suddenly got the urge to see the Summer Palace. He'd heard so much about it, but had never visited it, and he thought it might be a long time before he would have another chance to go. When he got halfway there, however, the road was closed. He guessed there was something going on, maybe some troop transfers at the restricted military area on Jade Spring Hill near the Summer Palace. When he got back to the workers' dormitory, he told everybody something big was going to happen in China, and it certainly did. In a short time, the shocking news was broadcast that Chairman Mao's designated successor, General Ling Biao, had betrayed the nation and attempted to flee, but his plane had crashed in Outer Mongolia. Fang Lijun refused to go to work again after that. He told me that he believed history had come to an end. He wrote a small note and went to the bridge between Zhongnanhai Party headquarters and North Lake, where he stuffed the note into a slit in the white marble railing. The note said, "History has already come to a halt and will no longer move forward. From now on, all new revolutions will be counter-revolutions. Don't try to fool me anymore. What right do you have to make me dig for coal?" His asthma flared up again and he stayed in the dormitory. No matter how much his work unit threatened him, he would not go into the coal pit again. He could not be sure whether it was in 1971, when United States Secretary of State Kissinger visited China twice, or in 1972, when President Nixon came. But anyway, the Americans brought with them a list of relatives of Chinese-American citizens who were being detained in China. At this time, when American-Chinese relations were thawing out in such a theatrical manner, in order to show their goodwill, the Chinese side allowed a group of people to leave the country. One of them was Fang Lijun. Because his father had long since left Nationalist Party political circles and had been granted asylum by the American government as a pro-American political refugee. When Fang Lijun received the notice, he went to the Public Security Bureau and was given a folded-up transit pass. He still strolled around the Summer Palace and the North Lake, enjoying the sights for a few days. Then he went back to the Taoist temple on the east side of Beijing to say goodbye to the old man who had raised him. When the old man heard his story, he was very worried. "Why don't you hurry up and leave?" he asked. "What if the policy changes and you can't get out? Go and buy a train ticket to Hong Kong right away today." The old man dug up a few pieces of gold leaf buried in one corner of the temple grounds. They were left over from some temple repairs, and he'd kept them there all these years. "Take these and trade them for money for your journey," he said. "Your mother was the temple's great benefactor. When she was in prison, she took our secrets to her death and firmly maintained that this Taoist temple was only involved in religious activities and had nothing to do with any reactionary secret societies. It's because of her that this 700-year-old temple still exists." Today, he could finally pay back the temple's godmother by helping Fang Lijun. The old man had raised Fang Lijun, but he had not revealed the truth about himself and the temple until this last moment. That's how wary people were of each other in those days. It was a good thing he took some money, because when the train south reached Guangzhou, Fang Lijun had to stay there a week, waiting to join in the quota for Hong Kong passengers. In Shenzhen, he had to wait 2 more days before entering Hong Kong. Without a passport or an identity card, carrying only a transit pass, Fang Lijun finally went through customs at Lo Wu Station, where they took his pass and allowed him to enter Hong Kong. When Fang Lijun went to the American consulate in Hong Kong to apply for a visa, he ran into a technical problem. He had not entered Hong Kong illegally, but had left China only on a transit pass. Therefore, he was not eligible to be a political refugee, and the Americans could not immediately issue him with a visa. He would have to apply formally for a visa on the grounds of family reunification with his father. Fang Lijun found temporary lodgings in a cheap guest house in the Chungking Mansions in Tsim Sha Tsui. He stayed there the better part of a year while the American visa process dragged on. While living in that guest house, he certainly broadened his horizons. He met backpackers and small business operators from as many as 50 different countries. There was an American hippie who was tired after spending several years in Goa and was now going back to America to join a hippie commune and continue to live his carefree, self-reliant life. Fang Lijun was extremely envious of him. Eventually, Fang Lijun went to Los Angeles and met his now quite elderly father, whom he hadn't seen since he was a small child. When Fang Lijun's father had run with Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Party, he had harmed quite a few people. He was very afraid that someone would take revenge on him, and so he hid at home in Monterey Park most of the time. He built a high wall around his house and even installed an iron door to his bedroom. The father had remarried, and Fang Lijun lived with them less than a month. Then he took his father's advice and moved to Texas, to the Houston Chinatown, to seek help from one of his father's former subordinates. He worked as an accountant on the second floor of this man's furniture and antique store. There was a teenage daughter, and the two families fondly hoped that Fang Lijun would marry her. She, however, was completely Americanized, and when she got wind of what her parents were up to, she refused even to eat with Fang Lijun at the same table. He took his meals alone in the shop storage room. This was certainly not the kind of American Chinatown life he had imagined. A few months later, Fang Lijun made contact with his hippie friend and left Houston for New Mexico to join the commune. It was located on a large piece of agricultural land where the members cultivated organic vegetables. They also made their own clothes, raised bees, and made jam and candles. They felt like they were self-sufficient, but their seeds, raw materials, tools and other everyday high-tech items, and their medicines, like Fang Lijun's corticosteroids for his asthma, were all purchased in the city. Living on a farm, they could not escape hard physical labour. Those hippies were all from middle-class urban families, and they found it pretty tough going. But Fang Lijun was used to hard work in China, and he was good at it, and could fix just about anything without a lot of talk. Because of all that, he was very well liked on the commune, and he spent many happy years living there. Unfortunately, in time, the commune began to split up due to squabbles between the hippies. And then the whole movement started to wane and most of the members drifted away. The great majority of communes were unable to keep going after the Vietnam War ended, and Fang Lijun's commune was no exception. There were no new members coming in, and although some of the old-timers came back, they soon left again. In the end, only Fang Lijun and an older woman everybody called Mom remained. Mom was resolved to stay on with Fang Lijun. There were only the two of them, and as the years went by, they were pretty much the same as a traditional husband and wife. One day in the early 1980s, Mom told Fang Lijun that she was getting too old to be a hippie anymore, and she wanted to go back east and live with her daughter. So the two of them shut off the water and electricity, boarded up the windows, and took a train across the United States to Maryland, where they split up. Fang Lijun headed north to New York, Philadelphia, and Boston. There, he ended up as a cook in a self-service chop suey joint in Boston's Chinatown. The boss liked him a lot too, and he worked there for several years. One day, Fang Lijun suddenly decided to go to the Harvard Yangqing Library, and from then on, he was hooked. He worked only in the evening at the restaurant, and in the daytime, he jogged from Boston Chinatown to Cambridge to read the Chinese periodicals in the Harvard Library. That was when he started writing letters to the editor at Ming Bao. That was me, Old Chen. In 1989, he really did return to the mainland. And in 1992, when Deng Xiaoping made his celebrated southern tour to promote economic development, Fang Lijun left China again. He always moved against the mainstream.